Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the latest in our series of Tineo Insights calls. When we started planning this session, what the popular press called Freedom Day was in touching distance. The idea was that on June the 21st, we would be fully and firmly out of lockdown, and we could look forward to a future largely free and worry about the virus. There are a lot of positives, but it increasingly looks like a number of restrictions will have to stay in place for a few more weeks. And longer term, we're realizing that there are a number of headaches. Today, it was revealed that more people have been vaccinated in Cornwall, where the G7 are meeting, than in the 22 poorest African nations. That's a huge problem if we genuinely believe no one's safe until we're all safe. In the UK, hospital waiting lists are at record levels, and the failure to help states school pupils during lockdown increasingly looks like a national scandal and long-term issue. Business faces the looming end of the furlough scheme, and the question of what the working environment should look like post-lockdown is still largely unresolved. This week, the CEO of Apple, the world's largest company, got a dusty response from staff when he suggested that they should be in the office 3 days a week. So this month is a milestone in our understanding, if not the way we'd hoped in terms of being free of the virus. There's a huge amount to discuss, and as ever, we've got the perfect panel to help people talk through it. Jeremy Farrar is one of the world's leading epidemiologists, and as such is director of the Wellcome Trust and a member of the SAGE Government Advisory Committee. Andy Bird is the CEO of the multinational education and publication business Pearson. Vicky Cook is a founding partner at the polling organisation Britain Thinks, and Amber Rudd is a Tineo senior advisor and former Home Secretary. Before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you have a question, please put it in the chat function, which is on the right-hand side of the screen, and I'll put the questions to the panel in the second half of the call. And if you're a journalist, please hang up now. This isn't meant for further publication or broadcast. So Jeremy, let's start with you. It feels like we've been lulled into a bit of a false sense of security regarding the violent virus and how soon we're going to be free of it. Give us a sense of where you think we are at the moment.
Yeah, thanks. A great pleasure to join. In the short to medium term, I'm probably as optimistic now for the epidemic in the UK than I've been for a very long time. And I also think this is the toughest decision faced by the government in the last 18 months. And I'll try and explain both of those, why I think that. The vaccine rollout has been nothing short of staggering. The science behind it, but then also the complexity of logistically getting it out to as many people in this country, at least, in an incredibly fair and equitable way, I think has been nothing short of staggering. The figures now are approximately, I may have got it a little bit wrong, but about 75% of all adults have had their first dose, and about 55 to 60% have had their second dose. The problem at the moment for the decision-making in terms of lifting is that the Delta variant, 617, originally described in India, is clearly much more transmissible. And in that community, both young people under the age of 18 and in the adult population that has not yet received their second dose, this virus has become the dominant strain over the course of 3 or 4 weeks. Absolutely incredible. It's gone from nowhere to become the dominant strain in the UK in about a month's time. And that has led to that famous R figure of about 1.4, 1.5, well above one, which is why we're now seeing a dramatic increase, and it is an exponential increase at the moment, in the number of infections in the country. The optimistic side is I believe the vaccines have separated the increasing caseload from people getting sick, going to hospital, and even those going to hospital are less severe than they were before the vaccine. So the overall story is very, very positive. It's a question of the decisions to be made for the 21st of June. And I think that at one end, opening all restrictions now on the 21st of June, the risk of that is that the exponential growth continues, the 40% of adults not yet vaccinated will get sick and will start to go to hospital. And I think within a month or so, you would have to impose further more draconian lockdown measures than are in place today. That's one scenario. The other scenario is that you delayed by probably a month, you kept the current restrictions in place, and you then vaccinated another 6 to 8 million people in the next month, and then you would be able to lift restrictions in a month's time. That's the challenging decision for government. The situation in the UK, absolutely fantastic, I think, frankly. Government deserve great credit for the rollout of the vaccine. globally, the situation, I'm afraid, is completely different. Your comment there that more people in Cornwall have been vaccinated than the poorest 20 odd countries in Africa is a tragic thing to say. And this is a public health, it's a scientific imperative, a moral one, of course. It's also, though, an economic and financial one, because if we don't vaccinate the world, new variants will come back, which will come to the UK and which may in the future escape vaccine protection. And that is the risk. This is a moral and ethical argument, but it's also a critical scientific argument and an economic one. We need to get the world vaccinated much quicker than the 1 billion doses by the end of 2022, or this vaccine, this virus will continue to reverberate, including back to the UK. So my message would be, we've done phenomenally well in this country to get the vaccine rolled out. We've separated infections from illness, but we're just not quite there at the moment. And the government's got a really tough decision to make. Back to you, Craig.
And thanks. Just very quickly, Jeremy, you say it's a tough decision. Just can I quickly ask you what your advice would be?
Is this public or is this a private conversation, Craig?
This is private.
I think to open up and then run the risk, which I think is probably 70-30, that a month later you would have to go back into full lockdown with all of the horror that that brings. I think where we are today, that's too big a risk to carry. And I would probably err on keeping the current level of restrictions, going to cricket matches, as we saw at Edgbaston this morning, or wherever it is, keep those restrictions in place probably for another month. And then I would be genuinely very confident that the full restrictions can be lifted.
Okay,
but it's a very difficult choice.
No, that's very helpful. And I'll remind everybody that we are doing this under Chatham House rules. So thank you for being open about that. Vicky, Britain Thinks has been doing a huge amount of work in where the British public is on this. Can you take us through the latest of where are they on this?
Sure, happy to. And actually, instinctively, without Jeremy's incredible scientific knowledge, they're in a very similar place. So I think what I was going to do is tell you a little bit about where the public are now, but also what they're looking for as we do start to emerge, because the public are now beginning to look forward to the future. They're feeling much more hopeful and optimistic. They're very, very tired. They're incredibly impressed by the vaccine rollout, and a sense that the end is in sight. But what they absolutely don't want is for us to jeopardise the end being in sight by having Freedom Day on June 21st. So most people are saying they're quite happy to continue with this level of restrictions for a while longer, till people have been double vaccinated, till we can be confident that we're not running the risk of another lockdown, because that's what they're most fearful of. But I think what's also really interesting is people are now beginning to think about the future. And I think there's this real sense of wanting society to emerge from this kind of fairer and kinder, and this not to have been for nothing. But there is low trust in government to drive this. And so a lot of expectations of what businesses and brands can do to help, and a sense that they really need to step up. And we've seen some kind of brands really celebrated through the pandemic. Because I think the public absolutely recognise that the pandemic has exacerbated existing divisions and really driven greater inequality. But it's also incredibly rapidly accelerated pre-existing trends. So through some work we've just been doing with the public and with business leaders, there are kind of four territories that we're seeing emerging that I'll just very quickly touch on in terms of what we do to come out of this. The first is we are now in a multi-mode world. The whole kind of mainstreaming of the multi-mode way of doing things, way of living, whether that's about shopping, where people want to blend now, kind of uber convenience, but they want to support local. And when they have a face-to-face experience, they want that to be a really great and different experience. So seeing ways that they're going to live their lives that bring it all together. Work. I mean, certainly right now, people do not imagine going back to the office 5 days a week. If they can work from home, they want to work from home some of the time, and 57% want to continue working from home some of the time. Now, that might, of course, change once people start to remember the benefits of being face to face. But right now, people want to see a blend. I think the second really interesting area is that health has become a much, much greater priority for people. So both mental health, which has kind of shot up the agenda, but also physical health, are kind of very front and centre in people's minds. And people really have a much greater understanding of the interconnectedness of longer-term health outcomes with short-term actions. So they're very full of good intent right now, but behaviour change, as we all know, is notoriously difficult. So, you know, 59% currently say that they're taking more steps to be healthy, maybe, maybe not. And 28% believe that mental health is the most important policy priority for rebuilding. So a real, I think, opportunity for businesses and brands to help people, to make it easier for people to make better choices, because they want to do it, but actually I think they need some help to do it. I think the third area, it relates to future fears. I mean, I think what the pandemic has done is kind of highlighted the fragility of our planet. So there really is now an ever-growing public demand for building more sustainable, resilient and equitable world for future generations. A real growing sense that the young people are the people who suffer the most and given up the most to protect the lives of older people. The particular emphasis on helping young people who really have given a lot. So, for example, 76% believe that businesses should do more to support young people after the pandemic, whether that's through jobs or training, just helping create opportunities that have been taken away from young people. And then our sort of fourth area relates to sort of connections and empathy, where there's a real opportunity to build relationships that go beyond transactional ones, where brands demonstrably living their values is incredibly important. And the indicator that people are mostly using is how they treat their staff. 82% believe that companies treating their staff well reflects directly on how well they will treat their customers. So actually seeing how people treat their staff. So I think imposing people going back into the office 5 days a week will play out very badly on a brand's reputation, because I think there's a sense that we need to kind of encourage people, work with people, recognize their kind of frailties and anxieties, and encourage them to come back in. So I think our view is that as we come out, there's a real sort of positive opportunities for businesses and brands to be part of that kind of positive change. But the only thing I would say, and this directly relates to a conversation I was having with you, Craig, is that some of the language business uses is very inaccessible to the public. So, you know, business leaders talk about ESG. Actually, wouldn't it be better if we talked about it in a language that the public understand, so they can see and recognise what business is doing to try and drive change and improvement? So hopefully that gives you a sense of where they're at and where they want to go. Back to you, Craig.
That's fascinating, Vicky. Just to remind people that they can put their questions in the chat function on the side of the screen. Andy, I'm going to come to you next. You've been running Pearson, a FTSE 100 company from California and New York for the last 15 months. How has that experience affected the way you think the working environment should be and how things are going to be going forward as we come out of lockdown?
Yes, thank you, Craig, and it's great to join you all from sunny New York City. As you refer to, I am your virtual CEO. I became CEO of Pearson last October, sort of at the height of the pandemic. And it has been a very, very interesting experience trying to learn a company, trying to get 22,000 employees around the world to know who I am, to understand the strategy that we've been laying out. It's also, I think, had its benefits. You can literally be in Asia in the morning and Europe, or Europe in the morning and Asia in the afternoon. And, you know, I've been doing town halls to 4,000 or 5,000 employees at a time. Obviously, you can't do that effectively in the physical world. So there has been some benefits. But, you know, I have not physically been in the same room, never met physically my CFO, to give you a sense of the impact this has on trying to run a business. And then more directly as it relates, of course, Pearson's the world's largest learning company, and you'll be familiar with the conversations around education and learning loss, GCSEs, examinations. Maybe we can get into that later or not. You know, our industry, like many industries, has been, you know, incredibly disrupted. Everyone's lives have been incredibly disrupted. We've had to learn about and had good and bad experiences around homeschooling. You know, we're very focused on the impact of learning loss, not just in the United Kingdom, but I think around the world. This is a really, really severe problem, and it's exaggerated amongst those disadvantaged parts of the population. So we are spending a lot of time thinking about how we can help in that regard. And it's also changed the face of learning. I think society generally, and our research has shown this, not just within learners, but parents have become more aware, I think through the great work of Jeremy and his colleagues in the United States. Dr. Anthony Fauci has become sort of the household go-to name in terms of the voice of reason, and the way that the scientific community have responded and created a vaccine in record time has in many ways increased the interest in the power of knowledge and the power of learning, both from formal and informal education. And we think that's a really interesting trend that's going to remain with us, as is the way that we learn. And this hybrid of way, you know, Vicky mentioned the return to work statistics. We're seeing the way that people want to learn, a hybrid approach between physical learning, whether at school, and another very important space is within corporations. We'll touch on that. And this virtual learning space, you know, in the United States, we run a virtual learning school. We've run it for the last 20 years. In fact, we are the 20th largest school district in the United States. And for the last 20 years, we've had hundreds of thousands of students who learn virtually. Some who have difficulties learning in a physical environment, and others, interestingly, are your Olympic athletes and those type of individuals for whom a normal school routine didn't work. When the pandemic hit, the enrollments went up 40%. And we've now seen that enrollment continue. And we're now seeing, even in the United Kingdom, where I have a personal example of one of our colleagues, where her son is taking A-levels and wants to take an A-level in Russian. And surprise, surprise, his local school doesn't teach A-level Russian. So the pupil will go to the physical school to take English, chemistry, biology, an odd combination, and then virtually learn Russian online in a virtual structured school environment. And then finally, I mentioned, you know, we're seeing a massive shift in terms of the need for reskilling and upskilling of employers and employees as companies. I'm sure many of the colleagues on this call are experiencing themselves adapting to the new needs. You know, we're talking to many of the large healthcare companies. And of course, one of the results of the pandemic has been telehealth, this two-screen notion of how you interact now. And the healthcare, large healthcare institutions, certainly in the United States, are saying, we don't need training in healthcare. We've got a lot of that. We need to train all our healthcare workers in digital skills. And so we're seeing a great deal of interest in the reskilling and upskilling areas.
Okay, Andy, that's really interesting and lots to chew on there. Amber, one of the big themes of these calls that we've been talking about is the bandwidth of government and whether or not they've got enough to deal with all the problems and things. What's your assessment of where they are now? They seem to be riding quite high in the polls, but endless stuff about various problems.
Thank you, Craig. Yes, riding quite high and seemingly untouchable. Every time something goes either right or wrong, the polls reflect an increase for Boris Johnson. And there's been much speculation about why that is, but I have my own view, which is that it's basically about injection. Anybody on this call, you know that when you go and get your jab, you just have a slight feeling of goodwill afterwards, a feeling of happiness and perhaps support for the government that you might not have felt before. So as long as that continues, I think that Boris Johnson will continue to ride very high in the polls. And it is pretty extraordinary that it is so consistent and so wide. And even the opposition, for a start, as we can see, has not managed to develop its own narrative of showing how it could be successful in government, and more specifically, how Keir Starmer could be a successful and authoritative prime minister. So they're continuing to languish. But this being the Conservative Party, the opposition often comes from inside, and even that has gone quiet. There certainly are people who will be getting ready to hold Boris Johnson to account for June the 21st. Should he delay along the lines that Jeremy laid out, which seems increasingly likely, and as Vicky said, it seems increasingly popular with the public, then there will be some pushback from them, but it'll be small, it'll be ineffective. Most MPs are interested in the polls. They're interested in how they're thinking about how they might get re-elected or not, particularly the new ones. So they're much more interested in what Vicky has to say than what some of the rebels within the Conservative Party have to say. So within the confines of the actual pandemic, the government continues to ride high for the reasons I've set out. However, within the actual parameters of getting things done, there is much more anxiety, as I, because as we all know, it's very easy to make statements about plans, about goals, about targets, but actually delivering within that plan is much more challenging. And that's where the government is beginning to realise that, well, as you put it, Craig, bandwidth is challenged given what they've been through for the past couple of years. But I would also say that some of these commitments that they've made are actually almost potentially impossible to deliver. And the one that we're living with at the moment is the Northern Ireland backstop, where Boris Johnson agreed a deal, declared a great success, and is now dealing with the reality of it, which is only made worse because the challenge of the Northern Ireland backstop is coming into protocol, rather, Northern Ireland protocol, is coming into play exactly when the G7 is here. So he's got, instead of the fantastic relationship with the Americans, plans to address climate change, plans to make sure that there are more doses of the injection to deliver to other countries. Instead of all that, we're getting much more about the Northern Ireland troubles and Joe Biden's view on that, which is absolutely, as you will recall from your days in Number 10, not the message they will want to be giving out. So there's some speculation that once the G7 is over, Boris Johnson may well be even more emphatic about his view about how we go forward with the EU on the Northern Ireland border, but he will be waiting until next week. Finally, the other point I just wanted to make, while the G7 is in operation and while Boris Johnson tries to show the world how we are on the world stage and what's his great opportunity of chairing it, he will also be looking ahead to COP26, which, as we know, is the United Nations-sponsored organisation to try to make sure that we address dangerous climate change, taking place in Glasgow this year. And unfortunately, there has now been a connection made by the less developed countries between actually attending and committing to COP26 and the support that they're going to get in order to get their population injected. And as Jeremy said, and it has been much quoted this morning, more people have been vaccinated in Cornwall than 22 African nations. And we forget sometimes, sitting here planning how far we can open on June the 21st. And as Andy was telling us, how New York is largely open and the Americans have their plan, but there are some African countries that are absolutely in the middle of the eye of the tornado at the moment. And they are not going to engage with this as we need them to do on COP26 unless we sort that out. So these two major global issues are now caught up in how the G7 is going to address supporting not only the pandemic, but also finance to getting climate change addressed.
Thanks, Amber. That's been really helpful because you've led me directly to the first thing I wanted to talk about, which is basically the state of the vaccination program. Jeremy, both in terms of the UK and globally, can you start with the UK? Where are we really? There's been a lot of hoopla about it, but are enough people being vaccinated quickly enough? When do we think it will happen, and when everybody is fully vaccinated, and when they are we safe?
Yeah, I think we are, actually, and I'm at the more optimistic end of the scientific view. The vaccines have been extraordinary so far, but also I think we haven't seen very many people who got infected in January and February of 2020 coming back with second infections. That tells me that the immunity is pretty strong. And we've seen people getting sick after two doses of vaccine, tiny numbers. So the vaccines are not just effective in the short term. I think they're going to be more effective than we think in the longer term. And that is why I'm much more optimistic about the future. But Amber's point about the geopolitics of vaccines now is absolutely right. We cannot bring the world together to do better surveillance for future pandemics, to address drug resistance, energy, water, mental health, whatever it is you think are the great challenges of the 21st century, the vaccine inequality, vaccine apartheid at the moment will make it extraordinarily difficult to bring the world together. And I'm afraid to say there are other countries who will exploit that. So that I think the West, G7 in particular, has missed an amazing diplomatic, geopolitical opportunity here, because other countries will step into that void.
And this mantra that we're not safe until everybody's vaccinated globally, how true is that? How worried should we be about the mutant viruses coming back and then maybe impacting us in the future, particularly if we are showing greater resilience after the vaccine program in the UK?
It's absolutely true that if you wanted to conduct an experiment to try and produce a new variant, you would allow transmission to be very high in big populations around the world. You'd vaccinate a small number of people in those countries. That would be the perfect environment to generate a new variant, and a new variant that's been driven by partial immunity, which would then come back to the UK. Just in the last 6 months, we've had four variants that have changed the pandemic. The September to December outbreak in the UK was driven by the 117 variant coming out of Kent. The Indian variant has led to questions about whether this lockdown can be lifted. The Indian variant drove the awful pandemic in India over the last 3 months that has been absolutely devastating. And that variant is now in East Africa, it's in South Africa, and it will go across the continent of Africa. So we are playing with fire by not making these vaccines available. In fact, we're conducting an experiment that would be beautifully designed if you wanted to create new variants.
Andy, I'm interested in your view as a CEO of this, because if you look at the business and financial pages, it seems to be suggesting that we're coming back very strong, everything looks like it's going to be okay, and businesses are basically seem to be fine. How worried should business be about this? And is it just a moral and ethical issue, but shouldn't business be much more worried about this, or actually should they just be concentrating on getting back to where they were before?
I think business should be very worried about it. We're very concerned about it above and beyond our sector in education and learning, because as Jeremy mentioned, ultimately, whether it's in Africa, Asia, the United States or other G7 countries, the population are your ultimate consumer. And the disruption to the consumer, whatever sector you're in, is going to have an impact on your business. Yes, there's the hassle of travel corridors and all of that stuff, but the real fundamental issue here from a business and economic standpoint is consumption of products and services by consumers on a global scale. We have become a global society, whether it's through supply chain. It's interesting, in the United States, there's a massive shortage of rental cars because of the shortage of microchips in terms of, all the big Hertz and National Rental Cars Enterprise got rid of their fleets when the pandemic happened. And as the United States is coming out and travel is freeing up within the United States, domestic travel is freeing up, they can't source enough new cars because of a chip further down the supply chain in terms of the manufacturer. So there are many, many business implications for the disruption that can be caused by the variability in vaccination. So I think it would be naive of any business leader to just focus on the social impact of this and not realize the economic impact that this has on society and can have on your individual business.
And is this global vaccine problem registering with the British public, Vicky? How high is it on their levels of concern?
It's there, but not expressed in quite that way. So I think that there is, there's quite a hard, awful lot of people saying we should just keep our borders as closed as we possibly can. So a sense that that's where we will get trouble in the future, because actually now so many of us are vaccinated and it's going so well here. So instinctively I think they understand the risks, but they're not yet fully relating it to the vaccination and vaccination apartheid, as you say. I think it's growing. I think people are becoming more, and particularly as they think, start to understand how we might have, amber, sort of green, amber and red travel zones, that relates to the degree of vaccination. So I think that will grow as a concern. But right now, it's a let's kind of hunker down. Quite often people will say, oh, why don't we do what Australia did? But I completely agree with what Jeremy said, that it's very hard to come out of that. I think where we're at the moment, people are saying, and it's only 20% of the population who are saying they think about a foreign holiday this year. Most people are saying, I'll happily give up on a foreign holiday this year if we get out of this.
It's interesting, isn't it, Vicky? Because if you were to read, the newspapers, I was just like looking at the front pages today and, flicking through them, you would think that the entirety of the British population is just desperate to be back to normal. But actually, the reality is, when you dig below the surface, there's a lot of people who would just rather stick at this level.
Well, and to be honest, what people will say to you is life right now is it's fine. It's close enough to normal. And you have got people starting to go back into the office a little bit. And I think the more we encourage rather than push, people are also seasonally quite worried because there's a huge amount of criticism of what we did last summer with Eat Out to Help Out, which the public say, well, that's why we had the third wave. So this sense that we might be kind of foolish enough to suddenly encourage everyone to go into crowded places, move around the country, just their instinct says that puts us all at risk. And actually being able to see 6 people inside, 30 people out, that's actually fine. We're all having a pretty good time right now.
Okay, Andy, I want to move on to this, working from home versus in the office thing. The reality of you since last October being the virtual CEO, has that influenced your view of the extent to which people should be back in the office? I mean, you've seen some CEOs try to be very directive and say there's a certain number of days and this should happen, and they've got pushback. And others saying, well, you can be, stay at home, and they've got a little bit of pushback because some people want some direction. Where have you landed on?
Flexibility, I think, is the key word. We have had throughout the pandemic many, many dedicated employees who've worked on the front line in our testing centres, providing critical support to both government and corporations. And there, that was like the NHS and others, is about protection and making sure that the employee safety. But we've said we're going to remain with our office-based employees, is it's up to you. I actually think, if you want to come into the office, come into the office. If you want to work at home, work at home. And actually what we're doing, we've spent the time during the pandemic to reimagine what the office is and why you go to the office. And the office is about community and collaboration. If we just need to sit on our desk and work in front of a computer, we've just figured out for the last 15 months how we can do that. And we don't have to commute anywhere to do it. Getting away from this environment to brainstorm about ideas, or to meet clients, or to just have a one-on-one confidential conversation with someone face to face. That's what's going to be important. So we're actually redesigning, our head offices in the Strand, 80 Strand, and our offices in the United States and elsewhere, become places that foster community and collaboration. And so you actually come to work in the office. You don't come to work for your desk. We're using technology, so you actually will book and say, I need a room with 5 people, and we need a whiteboard, and we need to do presentation. We're taking down walls. Everything is flexible. So the configuration of the office will actually change dependent on the needs of the employees in a particular location on a day-by-day basis.
So it's interesting that I find that talking about the needs of the employees, some people would push back and say, what about the needs of the business? And other people might push back and say, well, what about young people? They need to be in an environment where they're seeing and learning and growing. And it's all very well for older people to say, well, we've sort of managed for the last 15 months and that's okay, so we can be very, very light touch about this. But actually, longer term, are we not going to pay a price for it, Andy?
Well, if you want to, the flexibility, the onus is on the employee. If you want to come in 5 days a week, 4 days a week, then that's absolutely fine and we will accommodate you. But if you don't, or you want to come in for part of a day, or you want to come in 2 days, 3 days, 1 week, and then 5 days the next week, whatever it happens to be, we'll accommodate you as well. I think it's not black and white. It's not either or. It's this flexible approach to the needs and recognizing, you know, there are many individuals that working from home is not a hassle. There are lots of individuals, particularly young employees, young parents with young children, you know, employees who have just recently, you know, got together with their partner and they're living in very small home environments, flats, that's disruptive. The converse of this is great. I can now finish and I'm spending more time with my children. I can work my life around my child's, whether it's, you know, the school routine or whatever it happens to be. And we've had a lot of feedback, a lot of research from parents around, I still want to have that flexibility as well.
Amber, does the government have a view on this? Because presumably they're deeply worried. Anybody who's been into a sort of city centre recently can see, you know, quite how few people there are milling about and the impact on hospitality and restaurants and all that kind of thing. I mean, does the government think this is a bad thing that we're not going to all be turning back up the office 5 days a week and as a result, cities are going to struggle?
Yes, it does. But it's also been had its hand burnt by the Eat Out to Help Out. And as Vicky was saying, you know, that's got a terrible reputation. And I encounter people the whole time who say, oh, my God, they made such a mistake with that, didn't they? So they don't want to do that again. But on the other hand, they haven't made a decision yet about Whitehall itself, which is sort of fairly flexible at the moment. But they're longing to get people back to work because, as we know, the economy is supported by a lot of people in terms of the sandwich bars, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a tricky one. And my expectation is that they will just let people and businesses make their own decisions. And listening to Andy, I think that that will mean a continuation of the hybrid until people have more confidence or they just decide that this is how they want to operate now. So I don't think they're going to intervene because of the consequences of Eat Out to Help Out. And also, I do think that, again, as Vicky was saying earlier, is that the public have a kind of view now about what is and isn't dangerous. So I don't think they want to be encouraged to do any more sort of mixing around each other. We all know now how it's transmitted by air, etc. So I think they will tread carefully, although longing for people to get back in. I might have done a bit of boosting the economy myself over the past few days, doing a bit of shopping, and I was amazed how empty the shops were. I mean, they're still very empty.
It's extraordinary. I don't want to get too pessimistic in Game of Thrones about it, but winter is coming, especially as we've got a bit of sunshine at the moment. So, but I want to get some sense of where we're going to be in about 6 months' time. And I'm going to start with you again, Jeremy. Given the levels of vaccination, given what's going on in the world, there are things like COP26, which is coming up in November, which is a massive event. But also we're going to be in an environment where, you know, there's a lot of pressure on the economy and that sort of thing for various things. What should we expect in terms of the virus, given that, you know, winter comes and then that seems to have an impact in sort of speeding things up and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think through the summer, I'm talking now about this country, through the summer, the vaccines will increasingly be rolled out to the, you know, certainly down to the 18-year-olds. There's a big question about the high school students down to 12. But, you know, by the end, by the autumn, by the fall, essentially all over the 18s will have had two doses. And as I said earlier, I am more confident that that community will be protected, certainly from getting sick, if not necessarily from getting infected. And there may be a need in certain populations, senior people, the elderly, to give a booster to be sure we can get those people protected through the winter of 21-22. But I think this country will be in a good position by the autumn. And there will be a rebound of influenza. There's been no influenza in the world for 18 months now, and there will be a rebound of that. So there'll have to be a good rollout of the influenza jabs in the UK. But I would be pretty confident we will get through this winter in a pretty good shape. The biggest risk is importation of variants from the rest of the world. That, you come back to that issue. And I would at some point like to come back to Andy, because I think with the flexibility you describe, I absolutely agree with, and we will be doing, we're doing the same thing. The problem, which hasn't been really resolved, I think, is how do you work in that hybrid environment where one person wants one thing and somebody else wants another, but there is a reason to bring people together? And how do you impose a bit of mandatedness, if that's a word, on a very flexible agenda? And that's something we're struggling with a little bit.
Quickly, Andy, do you want to answer that?
We're struggling with it as well, Jeremy, and we're really spending a lot of time with the management population of smaller groups and teams so that they can understand the dynamic that is required, because you don't want to end up with a sort of a them and us, and you have those individuals who are just like kicking it back, sitting at home, and they're not part of the team. We're working through that.
So what another thing that's sort of expected to come through in the next 6 months is there's worries, if you read the sort of economics pages of the newspapers, about inflation returning, and then that needing to be controlled in terms of interest rates rising, the furlough scheme unwinding. Vicky, do you think the British public is going to suddenly realise that there's quite a lot of things that are leaving a bad taste in their mouths, and that will start to have an impact then?
They're pretty worried about it now. They'll keep saying, well, we've got to pay for this somehow. So I think people are anxious about it. And the population that kind of roughly falls into three: those who think we should absolutely prioritise health at the moment, those who think we should absolutely prioritise the economy, and those who are trying to kind of navigate a way through. So I think people are anxious. I think they're worried about their jobs. They're particularly worried about jobs and the future for young people who may not just even be able to get into the workplace. I think at the moment there's a bit of a sense that a bit of bemusement about why furlough was announced to be extended for such a long period and seemingly out of sync with the roadmap. So you're increasingly hearing people saying, well, business X seems to have chosen to stay closed, particularly in things like hospitality, when they could now be open. So I think there might be a bit of pushback that it's become a new form of unemployment benefit almost, particularly as employers can't get staff, where they're out of... I think financial confidence might get undermined. And yes, if we start seeing interest rates going up, I think that will build a lot of anxiety around the future of the economy.
Andy, are you worried about things like an inflation shock and furlough scheme unwinding and the impacts of that?
We didn't furlough any of our employees. We felt that the right thing to do was to continue paying all of them, and literally you can't work in the office, but you're still working for the company. That has been very well received. Clearly, there is. I mean, the United States released some of its consumer numbers a couple of days ago, and I think it was, memory serves me, 5.3% increase in consumer spend. I mean, I think there is such a pent-up demand led by Amber to go back into stores and consume and do things like that. You're going to see this natural peak. It's what happens and how it gets sustained that I think we've got to keep an eye on.
Could I just add something else?
Can I get you to deal with the, Treasury worrying about spending shock, and then you can put your other point in?
One of the things that the Treasury is concerned about now, because I spoke to a couple of MPs earlier in the week, is furlough and the fact that they have misjudged it and let it gone too far at the moment, because they're getting complaints from MPs that they're, the one I spoke to was saying that his local McDonald's won't open because they just can't get the staff. And that businesses are telling them that they've got jobs for people, but people are preferring to stay on furlough. And this is often for businesses that are going to close. They're not going to have a job there at the end, but they're just sitting on their furlough till the end of it. So this group of MPs I spoke to are lobbying the Treasury to bring forward the end of furlough, which seems extraordinary. But as he pointed out to me, they do U-turn on everything else. So why not on this? So I think, but I don't expect them to, but there is a kind of... irritation, which is consistent with what Vicky was saying she was feeling. I don't think the Treasury is that concerned at the moment about how it is going to recover the money. As we know, it's a it's not technically owed to anybody. It's just been printed by the Bank of England, so they're just going to sit on it for a while and then think about the electoral cycle, is my view.
Okay. A question from the audience here. It's for you, Vicky, from Anna Bartold. She's saying she's very interested to hear you talk about companies living their values, supporting civic society, and looking after their employees. Are there any brands that you think have done it particularly well over the last year, and what do you think the risks are of taking such a stance?
Thanks for that question, Anna. I think it's really, really interesting. I think what's absolutely at the core of all of this is whatever you do has to be authentic and true to who your business is. So an example of someone who's handled it really well all the way through is McDonald's. They just came up in that context. Because they closed their restaurants before they were mandated to, because they did it for the safety of their staff. And they put that message out really, really clearly. And every decision they took was employee first. And that was really recognized by the public. And they became a bit of a bellwether. So when we came out of one of the lockdowns, they all sort of morph in the end, don't they? But we did some work. We were doing the Brexit diaries, and we asked people to get their children to tell us what was going on. And we had this lovely drawing from a kid saying, "It's getting better. McDonald's has opened," and it became this kind of symbol of how you know the pandemic was playing out. But I think the risk is enormous if people do tokenistic things. I think what Andy said about the right thing to do if you could was not people on furlough. Lots of the public are picking up on things like that too. And I think angry with businesses that took money because they could rather than because they needed to. So I think it's incredibly important that any actions or behaviors you take come from who you really are authentically as a business or a brand. Otherwise, frankly, it's lipstick on a pig. You will be called out by your staff first, and that will then ripple through to the wider public.
Okay, thank you. We're coming towards the end of the call now, and it looks like there is going to be a bump in the road, but in reality, Britain is going to be largely out of lockdown, and we're going to be moving forward to a new era. I wanted to get each of your thoughts in terms of lessons learned and also what we might want to keep. So, Jeremy, starting with you, do you think we've learned the right lessons from this pandemic, and are you confident that if we were to face one again, we would do it much better? And what do you would you keep that's from having been in lockdown?
We certainly learned some lessons. We didn't learn them in September and October, but I think by tragically not until January, but I think on government decision making since January, I think it's been much better than it was through most of last year. Actually, the challenge is to get that reasonable decision making available on day one, and if you want to do that, you've got to have your systems in place. You've got to have Amber will talk about this, but I think a stronger cabinet office. You've got to be able to move to a better clarity about who's accountable for what and who's making decisions much earlier than happened through 2020. My concern on the pandemic, and going back to previous epidemics in history, the world moves on very quickly. All of the thoughts you have at the moment about, the world's a small place, we have to work together to get better surveillance and be better prepared for these shocks. Actually, the reality is the world moves on very, very quickly. And that's probably a good thing. But if we don't learn the lessons that these pandemics are more frequent and more complex, and whether it's climate change or any of the other great challenges, if we don't prevent them happening, we're going to have greater shocks down the road. And I hope we don't move on too quickly before we put better systems in place to be able to prevent and respond to them. What would I keep? I think the flexibility of work, I think, is a great opportunity to redefine the 8 to 6, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, weekend, 2 days schedule. And I think that is an amazing opportunity if we get it right, which I think we will all have a better work-life balance as a result of it. So that's something to keep hold of.
Andy.
I wrote down, I think, resilience. We all discovered how resilient we actually are. Adaptability through it all, in many different ways, good and bad. We managed to adapt to the situation that was presented to us. Picking up on Jeremy, what I mentioned before, I think flexibility, whether it's at work, whether it's through learning. I think we're going to remain flexible. we mustn't forget. I think what Jeremy's saying, you know, we've got to not just learn lessons from this pandemic, but make sure that we don't forget. You know, it's a pretty momentous. We've talked about how this will be written in history, and we're actually starting thinking about how we, you know, start writing that narrative now. And then finally, you know, as it relates to my own business, but I think society generally, and I referenced it earlier, is, you know, the power of knowledge, the power of learning, and the need, whether it's formal education or reskilling within the workforce, you know, we strive as a society through knowledge and learning, and that how important that is. So I hope that the, you know, that is a long-lasting legacy, and believe the scientists, not necessarily the politicians.
Always a good idea. Amber, you're a politician. What lessons have we learned? What would you keep?
Well, I'm vastly encouraged by some of the things that Jeremy and Vicky have said about how work-life balance has changed, and that's for the good, and how the public are going to be more demanding in terms of wanting their companies and the companies which they are customers on to treat people better. And I think that's all about the transparency that we've felt a bit more of, given the way everyone's been working. In terms of the politics of it and how governments respond, there is just one truth in my experience, which is that our government, and I don't know whether other governments are particularly consistent with this as well, but certainly my experience is that our government is not good at responding to major events. And the only ones it is reasonably good at, in my experience again, has been ones that has seen before and has practiced before. So what I would hope that the government will learn from this is that mistakes were certainly made, things could have been done better, and in order to make sure that the response is better next time, we need to practice more. You know, there are nothing beats sitting in a practice room at Cobra and thinking through how you would respond in certain events and getting that ready so that when this comes again, and we know it will come again in some form, there is some sort of handbook so that people know what the decisions are rather than suddenly thinking 3 months later, oh my goodness, we forgot the care homes. All these things could be better practice prepared for in the way that on many other big government, big events that hit the country, and I think particularly of terrorism, they're all those things we hope, but most of those things have been rehearsed, thought about who needs to speak to who, how the situation unfolds, what our protections are, what the PR is, all those things. And I think that is going to be an incredibly important learning for when it happens next time.
Vicky, a final word from you.
Thank you. So I would say, I think there are two things that I would particularly say. One is the increasing recognition of mental health. And I think the point was made about how resilient we are, and that is absolutely true for the majority of us. But there are a significant proportion of the population, including many, many young people and children, who've been desperately impacted by this and haven't had resilience. And I think actually really prioritising mental health and mental well-being is a hugely important thing going forward. The other thing which I think is really encouraging is the growing recognition of who really are the essential workers, and showing much greater respect for them. And it's obviously people like, you know, nurses and healthcare workers and social care workers, but also bus drivers, truck drivers, supermarket workers, people who get paid very little on the whole, normally are not shown that much respect by their fellow citizens. Suddenly we realise just how crucial they are. I think if we can build on that and value them more and show them greater respect, we will start to tackle some of the, you know, in a small way, we'll start to tackle division in society, which must be for all of our good.
And that's a great point to end on. I learned a huge amount from the panel today. They were all great. The virtual CEO, you're going to be getting a virtual round of applause, I'm afraid. But listen, thank you very much, Jeremy Farrar, Andy Bird, Amber Rudd and Vicky Cook. You were fantastic. We learned a lot and we really appreciate it. Enjoy the Euros and we will see you for another Insights webinar very soon. Thank you very much.